Okay, great. So they asked me to talk about stablecoins. I've been talking to friends about stablecoins a lot over the last little while, and so I'm very excited to kind of share my thoughts and where I think they're going and why I think it's important for Ethereum. So I'm giving them a second to put the slide on, because this is a different slide. You guys almost got it? By the way, I'm probably going to skip through some parts of it because I think we have 20 minutes and I've put together like a 30-minute presentation. But I'll do my best to make sure I kind of like share what's interesting to me.
Right, I think we have a little technical issues on the most tech conference, but it's happened sometimes. Yeah, so sorry about that. I think we probably need a few minutes. So Liam, not sure if you're comfortable to share something about what's like about the talk today.
Yeah. Okay. So I can share a little bit about it. So some context. Why am I even interested in stablecoins at all? Like my background in this industry has been as an engineer. Like I've been predominantly focused on like building scalability solutions and on like doing hackathons and all the tech stuff. But stablecoins have always been sort of like outside of the realm of the technology. They've been a lot more like around exchanges. They've been sort of opaque and confusing. And even when I talk to folks at like dinners in this industry, like there's not a kind of a coherent understanding of why are they relevant? What is it about them that's special? And you know, you can use phrases like people, you know, build stablecoins on Ethereum, or is it the case that stablecoins are enabled by Ethereum, or is it the case that stablecoins are just like a customer of Ethereum? It's unclear why they're so impactful. And so what I wanted to do in this whole presentation and just the past several months of thinking about stablecoins is kind of demystify it, understand how they came to be and what is it about them that might be the thing that makes, ultimately might be the biggest impact of crypto going into the future. So that's where I'm coming from with this. All right, let's do it. So I already just jumped into a bit of it. Why do we want to make sense of stablecoins? Last year, I took a bit of a step back from being really hardcore in the tech of the space, and I wanted to see where are the real-world adoption of crypto. And one of the most like jarring things when you kind of talk to people and you look at the data is that the biggest use case of like payments in crypto, shockingly, is not even on Ethereum at all. It's on Tether on Tron. And that led to like writing this blog post earlier this year, which kind of dove deep into how that happened, which I'm going to talk a little bit about in this presentation. And I wanted to see, well, if we're building all of this decentralization infrastructure, is it the case that the lasting impact might actually not even be on Ethereum at all? And how does the industry maybe evolve in a way that we don't end up in that scenario where, you know, Ethereum is just kind of this niche cypherpunk movement and doesn't actually end up mattering a lot in the rest of the world? So I wanted to kind of figure that out. So I'm going to dive through what is it about stablecoins that have product market fit, and then the history of how we got there, and then I'm going to speculate a little bit about where I think we're going to go next. So why is it that stablecoins have product market fit? I want to start with just some mind-boggling stats. Nearly $180 billion now are in circulation of stablecoins, and this is a 400x in the past 5 years. So, you know, and this is not even that long ago. Like, this is still like after the ICO mania era. We still had a 400x in stablecoin supply, and it's not just like resting there. People are using it for moving money around, and they're using it not only just for speculation purposes, but they're consistently using it month over month for all kinds of purposes. And you can see volumes, this is from Visa's on-chain dashboard, and transaction counts are just up and to the right. And the cool thing about it is that it's not just tethered to speculation. You can see, even as, you know, NFT craziness happened, ICO mania, the recent meme coin mania, stablecoin transacting addresses, and also the transaction counts just keep going up and to the right month over month. And if you're in crypto and you see something like this, that's not a crazy, you know, bubble up and down, this is like beautiful, because it means there's like something here that, you know, is sustainable and long lasting. So what exactly is going on? One of the best indications of why this is valuable I've seen is the simple use case of accessing the dollar. And here's like a really clear chart of how you can understand why it's so valuable. In Argentina, as the purchasing power of the Argentinian peso has gone down, I think like 82% in the past couple of years, there's been a 10,000% increase in stablecoin trading volumes in that area. It's in essence, and you can go there and talk to the people, their currency isn't working for them, but stablecoins are giving them a really easy way to kind of get access to a stable currency for their everyday basic financial needs. It's not about crypto token trading, it's about genuinely improving their lives and the financial access that they can get. And there's this really great survey that came out, I think about a month and a half, by Castle Island Ventures, Brevan Howard Digital. They went around to these countries where, you know, there's charts just like the one I showed you, and they asked people, what are you doing with these stable coins? And, you know, the biggest answer actually was not on this slide. 50% was, you know, crypto trading and NFTs, but it was just 50. And 47% is still saving in dollars, as well as pretty high percentages are just getting currency conversion benefits, they're earning yield on their savings, they want to move money internationally. And so it's indicative that people are using stablecoins not just for trading, but also for real important elements of their financial lives. And there are businesses being built now that facilitate this. Bridge, for example, this is a screenshot from their documentation. It's effectively giving all of the movement of money products that you might need to kind of benefit those use cases or to enact those use cases as an API. And that's one of the reasons why they were so valuable. And those APIs are being used for products like remittances, loyalty point conversion, a smorgasbord of financial use cases in Argentina with Lemon. Stripe now supports payments in stablecoins as well as payouts to people after you've accrued that capital. And PayPal is entering the game with both like a payments product and a branded stablecoin product. And I showed the Bridge docs, and if you don't know, just I think a week and a half ago, like not too long ago, Stripe acquired that company for $1.1 billion, which is the largest acquisition in the history of the industry. So this is not just something that's kind of happening and is kind of rising. This is already enormously valuable, and big players are taking note. And if you don't know this fact, hopefully you know at this point, the business of being a stablecoin issuer is insane. Tether is, I think, the largest, or it's the most profitable company by headcount in the world. So far this year, they've already earned nearly $8 billion in pure profit on the yields from the treasury bills they buy with the stablecoins that the cash they get from the stablecoins they issue. And this is on the level of nation states. Like, Germany and Mexico are kind of in the same order of magnitude in terms of treasury bill purchases as kind of a combination of Tether and Circle. So it's just wild. It's kind of what I implore to you how big this has gotten. And it's not like this is some other things in crypto where it's very regulatorily challenging and confusing. There's a huge group of people lobbying for regulation across the world, and regulators, especially forward-thinking governments like the Singapore Money Authority and the Central Bank of the UAE, they're already adapting to stablecoins and writing policies to regulate issuance and make sure that it's done correctly. So the world is adapting to this in a way that has not as much done with, say, tokenization. So, you know, what is about the product market fit? It's the fact that stablecoins are programmable, they're highly traceable, they're fungible, they're interoperable, they settle instantly, 24/7, they're global. It's programmable money. It's a better form of money that make them so useful. So that's what's going on. It's a pretty big deal. I wanted to understand, why is this happening, though? How did we actually end up in this world where there's this new form of money, and how is it that it's all been kind of accepted, and this is now the new norm? And so I looked at the history, and just it's very interesting how it all occurred. It started in 2014, during a time when there was a lot of Bitcoin trading and new altcoins popping up. And a new coin was created by Brock Pierce, who actually was the guy from the Mighty Ducks movie. Which is really cool. And they announced RealCoin. And RealCoin, the pitch was basically today what you'd recognize as what's called a stablecoin today. It was get the advantage of the Bitcoin protocol to the dollar, meaning anyone can access it without a trusted third party, but it's backed one-to-one by a company's reserve. This was the first time this product was introduced. Later they renamed that to Tether. And I want to show what is it about that product that ended up being so useful with a kind of a very simple diagram here. At the time, there were a lot of these exchanges, and the supposed to be emojis in the bottom, that were opening up around the world to facilitate Bitcoin trading. People wanted to buy and sell digital assets, altcoins, Bitcoin, and so on. And they were trying to get banked with, for example, different banks around the world. But a big problem in this era, because of things like the Silk Road, was that you would regularly get debanked. You would have trouble making your exchange work. Because you couldn't get access to a US dollar bank account. What Tether realized is that is a solvable problem by bundling the relationship to the banks and sort of going directly to the exchanges that want to facilitate those exchanges of digital assets and effectively use blockchains as the ledger. So Tether could go to the banks, the exchanges could leverage Tether for on and off ramping of assets, and there'd be a much more sort of decentralized way in which people got money in and out of exchanges. So this helped exchanges all over the world start trading digital assets. But the other really important thing that it did is it enabled, because blockchains are open protocols, they're not closed silos, siloed banks, it enabled inter-exchange arbitrage, which is really interesting. And you can see how, this is a bit later on, as the trading volumes of crypto assets went up, so too did the supply of stablecoins. And the reason why is that when people wanted to trade digital assets, that led to huge price differences in different markets, which led to massive arbitrage opportunities, which means if you want to make money in an arbitrage opportunity, you want to flood liquidity into those exchanges and do the market making that you have to do to kind of get the prices all in line and earn your profits from arbitraging. And who was doing this? It's kind of interesting to see the history. The biggest one by far was Alameda Research, SBF. There's also Cumberland, other market makers. What they were doing effectively is going to Tether, giving dollars, getting Tether back, going to exchanges, and then putting liquidity across multiple exchanges to arbitrage across them. And that is what caused a huge spike in the supply of Tether. And ultimately drove huge numbers of transactions through the blockchains that were the things that tethered them together. Really interesting kind of quirk of history is that it started out on the Omni network, which was back in the day when they launched Tether, pre-Ethereum was Mastercoin, which is actually the product that Vitalik almost joined before they kind of rejected him and he went and started Ethereum. But then Ethereum took over as the ERC-20s became very popular. But because Ethereum didn't scale, Tron was able to kind of take a bit more of the market over time. And now we're in this kind of equilibrium where it's kind of Ethereum and Tron are the main places where stablecoins end up living for this sort of inter-exchange arbitrage opportunity. Another cool part of this was that Binance played a really big role. As more and more people were buying digital assets in all these different countries, Binance was really effective at getting huge numbers of users on their platforms, and when it came time to kind of move assets in and out of Binance, they would end up using Tether, they'd end up using Tron because of what actually ended up becoming the default way to move Tether in and out of Binance was via Tron. I don't know exactly how that deal ended up being arranged, but it kind of cemented Tron as kind of the place that you ended up using Tether for a lot of places where people had Binance accounts. And that ended up now into the situation that we find ourselves in where there's huge amounts of supply concentrated in Tether. Binance is still the largest holder of Tether and other exchanges, pretty far beneath it actually, and supply is on Ethereum and Tron. So that's how we got here. And so I looked at that and I was thinking, okay, what are the network effects that maybe we can observe occurred between those companies and maybe are potentially going to be important going into the future? And what I want to kind of posit to everyone today is that there's three really interesting players in here, which are stablecoin issuers, blockchains, and ramps. And you can look at this diagram. I'm not going to go through all the labels, but you can see there's a lot of very naturally occurring network effects between these three sort of entities. Stable coins obviously earn huge amounts of yield. That's reinvestable for all kinds of purposes. Apps drive the transactions. Those are the things going and getting customers to put money into the system for whatever use case, trading or whatever it might be. And chains ultimately are the places where transactions settle, fees can accrue, and it's also where liquidity aggregates. And I want to say, historically, I think these three players were really successful at kind of leveraging some of those network effects. And it's one of the reasons why they've kind of gotten themselves into that very dominant position in the market. And similarly, today, if you look at what's going on with Coinbase, Base, and Circle, I think that they're replicating a lot of these benefits. But something interesting has happened in the past few years, which I think is very exciting, and it's worth everyone kind of being aware of, which is that this has sort of changed. And so I'm going to explain what's changed and why it's gotten easier. Historically, it's really hard to do any of these three things. Every time there's a new chain, it's a new algorithm, it's a new token, it's a new foundation, it's a new, you know, new brand, it's a new community, it's a really complicated endeavor. Every time there was a new stablecoin, it's again very complicated. You have to get all these banking partnerships, you have to build a brand for your stablecoin. It's a very big business. You know, these are companies that are getting started. And similarly with ramps or exchanges, whichever kind of term you want to use, these are very big businesses too. You're going to Times Square billboards, driving people to want to buy and sell crypto assets. And so this has been very hard. But in the past few years, this has radically changed. We've solved scaling for the most part. We've made it very low fee and very easy to launch a new blockchain. Similarly, stablecoin issuance has gotten a lot more normalized. And you can launch a stablecoin through something like a Paxos or a Braille. And SEXs are being unbundled into APIs. What I showed with Bridge earlier, their documentation, is effectively something that people are leveraging exchanges for historically now as an API. So it's kind of this like unbundling of the things that those businesses did and being made available for people to build on their own. So examples, you can now launch a new blockchain like you launch a new server using Conduit, Alchemy, or any RAS platform. You can now launch a stablecoin like you would work with any other vendor. There are plenty of vendors that will help with the regulatory components and figure out how to pass the yield to you or your customers. And ramps are, you know, there's a huge industry of ramps, and I have a slide showing some of them later on, that now are possible for you to integrate with for your business. So the question I kind of pose is like, okay, in a world where we don't need different companies for each of these kind of three kind of pillars of the industry, what things can get built? What fills in these circles? And what I'll posit is that it's all about distribution. This is what I've been really occupied with in the past little while, is how do we get more and more companies that have huge amounts of distribution, like, you know, the top apps on the finance page in the App Store, the Revoluts, this is America, it's not Revolut, but the Cash Apps, the Robinhoods, you know, the Venmos, PayPal, how do we get them, who have huge customer bases, to want to integrate with Ethereum? Because if we can bring hundreds of millions or more users effectively through their distribution, that might be the fastest path for us as the Ethereum community to get this technology to the masses. And I think there's three major kind of ways you can look at this in terms of how it'll evolve. I think the apps are going to be a lot less speculative in this world where distribution is the most important part. It'll be a lot less about how do you buy and sell crypto assets and more about how do you do payments, cross-border, commerce, settlement, how do you kind of provide consumer fintech products. The chains will be a lot less narratively driven. Personally, I think it's a lot less exciting what the next Ethereum killer is. They're very incremental. It's going to be a lot more interoperability driven. How do you make it so that your chain connects with sort of the city of Ethereum? And you know, how do you make it so that your chain is also going to benefit your customers? I'll give an example about what World is doing with WorldChain. But if you have a World ID, you're kind of privileged on WorldChain in a way which attracts you to that chain. I think that's the kind of thing that'll differentiate chains into the future. And then stables, it'll be a lot less about sort of the branded stablecoin, how do we get maximum liquidity, and a lot more about just these short-term journeys where money goes into a stable temporarily for the benefit of moving it, and then comes back out later. So that's kind of my thesis. And I'm hoping that we'll see a world that looks a bit more like this, where PayPal, through the combination of stablecoin issuance and the combination of leveraging blockchain platforms, will be able to kind of effectively take a lot of the values that we've kind of embedded into the technology of Ethereum and bring it to their customers. So That's where I think things might be going. I think for Ethereum to win, there's three major areas that it needs to focus on. Like if I was CEO of Ethereum, these are the kind of things I would like make sure like are really being nailed. One is access, two is liquidity, and three is interoperability. Pretty straightforward. Access basically means if you are someone that has a business in any one of these countries or anywhere else in the world where there's huge, you know, very disparate patchwork of banks, how do we make it so that no matter where you are, no matter where your money is, you can get it into Ethereum through some RAM provider, some API, some through some means. And this is, you know, Ethereum has a huge head start. It's been around for nearly a decade. We have tons of integrations already, and I think we can leverage also all of these companies that have been built in our ecosystem to get all of that, all those integrations done. And if we do that, it's going to make it incrementally easier for companies like a Dymo, which has building sort of an app on the App Store. You download it. If it's possible, no matter where you are in the world, to just get your money into this app, all of a sudden we have sort of a universal Venmo that just works for everyone. So it's the access is really, really important. The second one is liquidity. Ethereum is way ahead on this. We're already by far the largest aggregator of capital in this industry. I think it's really important that we continue to double down on that and we don't lose sight of that. And it's been great to see in the past, you know, year, the Ethereum Foundation and Ethereum researchers have really focused on DeFi as a use case. I think the fact that Ethereum is kind of the New York of the, you know, the city on Mars, which is what Paradigm calls it, is really, really important. And we have to continue to aggregate that liquidity because it's that liquidity aggregation which enables this kind of use case where because Ethereum has it all in one place, we can enable really low fee FX conversions, for example, on chain in a way that competes with Wise. You can almost think of Wise as like a blockchain in a sense that has a ton of integration partners that they've manually had to build up over the past decade. But compared to the aggregate manpower of the entire Ethereum industry, I don't think it can compete. Similarly, you can see more apps like Stable, which effectively is going out and saying, hey, the crypto economy has really good yields, and so if you want to get access to the best, highest dollar-denominated yield that's, you know, obviously there's risk and so on, but relatively risk-free comparatively, you know, just one, you know, download the app, Face ID, and get that value. So that's the liquidity. And then the final piece is interoperability, which is, I want to describe in kind of two different ways. One is super apps. So if you're not familiar, a super app is an application like this one, which has tons of different use cases all in one single app. This is very popular, especially throughout Asia, WeChat, Grab here, and so on. I think that super apps might be a type of application that Ethereum can really accelerate the developments of. And I'll kind of give like a really fast pitch as to how that is. If you think of a super app, you start with some concept of identity. So like WeChat, you know, has all WeChat users in China, for example. Some integration with a payment system, integrations with other companies and products, and then engagement with the application. I think the cool thing about Ethereum is that it makes this step permissionless. Meaning instead of having, you know, if you want to build a super app, going out and building hundreds of partnerships to get them into your application, Ethereum lets you have permissionless partnerships. And I can give the example of WorldCoin, which has about 15 million people now that are signed up for an orb. They are all effectively able to using the World app, they're able to kind of access different applications permissionlessly through something called Minikit, which is going to end up showing up on the World app using mini apps. And the reason why it's possible is because of this kind of permissionless integration, anyone can create a mini app. I'm going to skip over the partnerships example, but the TLDR is maybe through Ethereum we can enable partnerships between brands in a way that they already kind of want to do, but with Ethereum it's a lot easier. So those are the three things. In short, I kind of went over them. Access, liquidity, and interoperability. Those are the three most important things I think that Ethereum really needs to nail. If we get these down, then I don't think really any other ecosystem can compete.
All right, Liam, I think I need to cut you off because it has to be on time. I'm so sorry. Do you want to say it?
I got one more slide. Let me do one more slide really fast, if I can. Okay, screw it. I can do it? Okay, I just want to share this one meme. I think that stablecoins are basically the gateway drug to Ethereum. If we can get this use case really nailed, I hope is that in the future, we get kind of the technology of Ethereum in the door, into the hands of consumer fintech, and it's by espousing our values and coding it into the technology, and then selling it via stablecoins that will get Ethereum into the world. So, yeah, thank you very much.
All right, let's give him a big round of applause. Wow. Thank you. And I think Stablecoin is really taking the world right now. As you can see, it's full house. Okay, let's do Q&A. Do you think we should have spent more time thinking about transaction privacy for stable before the space grows too much?
Yeah, this is a really fantastic question. I think one way of thinking about Ethereum is it's kind of similar to BitTorrent in the sense that it's the alternative thing that you could use if you didn't want to use whatever else society gives you. And I think that this is the kind of a feature that Ethereum, we believe in, right? It's kind of part of the cypherpunk ethos. We should embed it, right? There's a counterfactual version of the world where we don't have privacy. You know, this technology goes mainstream and privacy just wasn't implemented in time. And we've almost normalized this. So it's actually a good thing for Ethereum to think about is how do we make sure that we codify into the protocol the things that really must be there, such that in a world where, you know, technology just lifts off in a way that we can't control, the key things we really need to be there are actually in the protocol. So yeah, I think privacy really needs to be emphasized very highly at the EVM layer for sure.
Okay. And what's your opinion about why wouldn't government just crush third-party stable and enforce CBDC instead?
Yeah, I think the bull case for this is that Ethereum is credibly neutral block space, right? It's kind of like, is it really possible to get a bunch of different government entities all to collaborate on launching some sort of a chain that has this level of liquidity and this level of interoperability across the world's banking systems? Like, it might not be possible. So I think the fact that Ethereum is credibly neutral means that people want to integrate with that, and it becomes the thing that governments themselves integrate with, even if they do a CBDC.
Okay. Next one. Do you think there's demand for non-USD stablecoin? Or do you think, what about it? Yeah, what do you think?
Yeah, I think my take on non-USD stablecoins is that it's probably going to be the case that government entities are going to want to prioritize their local currency in a world where stablecoins do take off anyway. But it's kind of like I said with the BitTorrent example, it's the alternative you could go to. So if it's always possible to just go to your laptop and effectively get access to the US dollar, then you're not in your government's currency sucks. You're probably just gonna go get the US dollar. But if it's the case that your government's currency actually is reasonably well run, like in the case of maybe in Europe, people prefer the euro over the dollar, then maybe people will use euro stablecoins there in a world where this stuff takes off. So the good thing about this technology is it raises the bar of the credible alternative you could use if your local kind of more centralized version isn't that great.
Okay, I think we've got 40 seconds left. What are the most promising decentralized stablecoin in your opinion? Crypto wasn't meant to be secured by a company's bank account.
Yeah, this is a good question. I don't know. I've been a fan of DAI since the beginning. I think Sky is a great protocol. I use Sky a lot. But I don't know where this is going to go, honestly. The hard part about decentralized stablecoins is that they're fundamentally, it's way harder to build one of those than it is to build a centrally issued one. I think that this industry would have to kind of espouse like its values on stablecoins, and we'd have to all agree that the denomination on like DEXs, instead of it being USDC or USDT, it should be DAI. But that's going to take a lot of political willpower, I think.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Liam Horn, thank you. Thank you for your inspiration and insight talk about stablecoin.